His head is full of garbage. It's full of indoctrination. It's full of Guatemala. This warped mother-son relationship, marked by rage and frustration on each side, changed dramatically one evening when Krishna went to buy some marijuana. He was 15. We were kicking it right on Bloomington and Lake Street when a red Lincoln pulls up and a dude starts blasting at us, he recalled. The police questioned everyone who was there, but detained Krishna in relation to the murder of a 39-year-old black man the preceding month. I thought they were trying to scare me at first, he continued. Black gangs fight black gangs, and Chicano gangs fight Chicano gangs. We like killing each other, I guess, so no way was this me. But the police soon filed charges against Krishna. When Carol learned that her son would be tried in the adult system, she organized friends to write letters, protest, and pack the courtroom. She explained that Krishna had previously been kidnapped and was traumatized. For the first time in Hennepin County, a murder case stayed in the juvenile system. Krishna faced an uphill battle. My lawyer'd be like, well, they offered us 15 years. Us? Motherfucker, you gonna do 7.5? I'm gonna do 7.5? I was like, I'm not gonna plead guilty to something I didn't do. Krishna was steely in his resolve, and the case was finally dismissed. By then, he'd been in jail for 7.5 months. When they let him go, everyone thought, he'll really turn his life around, Carol said. But he got right back into it. For once, Krishna agreed with his mother's version of events. Being locked up made me think, fuck everybody, he said to me. Things did not go well at home. Anyone who came to the house with a blue kerchief, a Sereno symbol, Carol kicked out. Krishna said, I think a mother should be until the end. Even if I was doing life in prison, she'd still try to be there for me. I was testing her. She replied, Krishna says he wanted to stay in Minnesota to make my life miserable, and that's why he kept himself in the gang. It's to see if I really love him. I don't think he planned it at all. The gang and the cult are the exact same. Very hierarchical, rules, this small group of people dedicated to this pointless rigid structure and ready to die for it. He's recreating the childhood he hated. 2 months after the charges against Krishna were dropped, he served a 1-month sentence for having a gun. A few months later, he was picked up for parole violations, and at 16 he was sent to a year at the county home school, where I met him. Krishna told me that his girlfriend was pregnant, which she was not, and added, I don't want Carol to even see the kid. I don't need her talking about your first years were really something else. Krishna's ability to be angry at his mother for something she hadn't said to a baby who didn't exist was an impressive feat of projection. A little later, Krishna said, I was just thinking how if my kid grew up to be like me, it would be my fault. That almost made me cry. I wanted to cry. My eyes kind of swelled up, but no tears. Anger had apparently crowded out all his other emotions. I could handle it if he were one of those kids all dressed in black, with blue hair and piercings, Carol said. Even tattoos, if they're not gang-related, are fine. Even if he were gay, fine. I can never be fine with violence, and I wonder if that's why he chose it. They've got his back. Why do they have to have his back? Does anyone have your back? My medical insurance has my back. One thing he's proud of in the gang is that he tells other people what to do. He's always on that cell phone barking out orders in Spanish. I said to him, look, I tell people all the time what to do, because I teach first grade. Would you consider it as an alternative? But Carol also admitted that she is in part responsible for who Krishna is. You know me as who I am now, and I know you like me, she said sadly. But believe me, I wasn't the same person then, and you wouldn't have liked me so much. She also thought that the complexities of being part white were too much for her son. He's too scared to be himself. It's hard for mixed-race kids to stand up and say, I am neither here nor there. I am myself. In a letter Krishna wrote me, he said, It would make sense to tell you who I am, even though sometimes I don't even know. Always classified as a spick for my language, culture, looks, and demeanor, but always teased, ostracized, and not fully accepted by my Latino brothers for being a half-breed. Krishna loved giving tutorials about gang life. The Hispanic gangs in California have been going since the 1900s, he told me one evening. I'm not putting down black gangs, but there's more loyalty and honor with us. Gangs didn't really start as criminal organizations. They degenerated into that. But look at the people in Enron stealing old people's retirement funds. I, myself, or any of my homeboys, that's a rule that you can't fucking jack old people. That's despicable. When I met Raul 3 years later, I saw that Krishna was echoing the tone of his father's earnest moral instruction. Most of the kids whom I interviewed for this chapter spoke correct English when they first met me, and then relaxed into patois. Krishna spoke broken gang language, full of obscenities, until he relaxed, at which point he spoke perfectly grammatical English. Was his gang mode a defense to camouflage the sensitive person he really was? Or was he an incredibly hard guy who could manipulate people with his apparent softness? Krishna himself has no idea of the answers to these questions. In the final month of his sentence, Krishna went out every day to a job and could leave the premises in the evenings with a responsible adult. I had applied for permission to take him to dinner. When we had sat up nights in the homeschool, he would talk about how he wanted to go to college. Now, as he tucked into a sirloin, his fixation was the gang. Those are my people, he said. I ain't going to be sacrificing my loyalties just for living under Carol's roof. I mentioned that I had been interviewing Karina Lopez, and he laughed. You heard her boyfriend died? My boys did that. He actually thumped his chest. I saw her the day it happened in the med unit crying her ass off. I laughed. Karina later confirmed the episode. He didn't have anything to do with the murder, but he sure enjoyed it. I told him that it was hard to reconcile all this with the boy full of dreams with whom I'd played Scrabble a few weeks earlier. They're all part of one person, though, he said. My counselor just made me do an assignment on what a psychopath is. After reading 20 characteristics, I stopped, because it was scary. I loved my hatred. It's so strong and sort of pure and real. And I kind of hate love. Like I feel it's always false and disappointing. Everyone saying they love me when they just want to control me. I love hatred, and I hate love. So is that enough for me to be a psychopath? I don't think I'm evil. I hope not. 3 days later, Krishna went to his job and didn't come back. To run away when you have 2 weeks of transitional living remaining is ludicrous. Instead of walking out with a clean record, he was on the lam. After 3 months, he was picked up in South Minneapolis and returned to the homeschool. When I saw him there, I expressed mild surprise that he had stayed in a town where every policeman knew his face. I went to the Greyhound station twice to buy a ticket to L.A., but I was having too much fun here, he said. He complained that Carol had reservations about having him move back home. Did my mom let me down? He asked. I don't think she let me up to begin with. Carol was sad. He somehow missed the lesson on delayed gratification, she said to me. I wish you could take over being his mother. Krishna began what I was to recognize as a predictable cycle. As long as he was locked up, he was capable of optimism and hope, qualities that dissipated when he left his confinement. Now he wanted to stay in gang life but not commit crimes, and he planned to do this by writing plays to be performed by gang members. He would beat their knives into scripts, their guns into production values. After describing to me the plot of one of his stories, he became abruptly ruminative. "I'm a banger. That's just the easy way out for me. That way I know where I stand. Whereas, when I'm trying to be positive, I don't really know where I stand, and I don't really know how committed I am to being positive." I had heard a great deal about his father, and wanted to see if Raoul was the gentle sage of Krishna's raptures, or the manipulative creep I'd heard about from Carol. 3 years after I met Krishna, he was free and planning a trip to Guatemala. I proposed to his father that I visit at the same time. Raoul wrote back, "You are welcome any time. You do not have to spend your money and time in a hotel. It will be our pleasure to have you with us so we can meet and talk freely." Raoul was warm and courtly and instantly likable, a small man with thick black wavy hair. He looked almost Asian and was dwarfed by his towering son. They met me at the airport. I threw my bags in the trunk of their elderly station wagon, and we headed to Krishna's grandparents' house, where I was given a room ordinarily reserved for visiting grandchildren, which had on the dresser, incongruously grouped, a light-up Santa Claus, a gigantic Mr. Potato Head, and a portrait of the Pope. Raoul told me that he and Carol had loved each other. "Before we married," I said, "I don't accept a marriage that leads to divorce, especially if there are children." But she left anyway, and she wanted to have them with her, which she hadn't earned and couldn't do properly. We stayed up talking late that night, and Raoul returned over and over to the language of morality. "I don't think this thing we see is the real Krishna," he said. "The real Krishna is that sweet boy who went up to visit America 5 years ago. The good side will come out on top, but whether it does so before he gets locked up for life or killed in a shootout, I don't know." Later he said, "I can understand being willing to die, or to spend your life in prison, but not for a gang. Krishna needs a cause." Raoul looked at me with sudden frankness. "Can you help him find one?" he asked. In the morning, we went to an Ananda Marga school in an impoverished district called La Limonada. The children, 3 to 6 years old, were taught in two rooms, one above the other in a concrete bunker with a tin roof. Raoul and Krishna were greeted with songs and a little dance, Krishna awkwardly receiving these salutations. The teacher asked if Krishna would give the kids English lessons, and he replied that his tattoos and gangster look would get him into trouble in the neighborhood, an excuse that clearly upset his father. Then Krishna said he had to bounce, so Raoul and I drove to a small apartment on the outskirts of town and met a dozen Ananda Marga devotees from various countries. We meditated on faded prayer mats and talked about good and evil over a shared bowl of lentils. That night, with bravado, Krishna took me to a gang-dominated part of the city, where he introduced me to the local sureños. Everyone had guns and gang tattoos, and at one point we heard gunfire outside the room where we were gathered. And yet, it felt weirdly like meeting someone's fraternity brothers on a college campus. I understood for the first time how sureños could feel both utterly dangerous and uniquely safe. The gang was itself a horizontal identity, and crime served a function in Krishna's life not unlike the role that deafness or dwarfism played in other lives I'd examined, not unlike the role that being gay played in my own life. I kept remembering the letter in which Krishna had said he couldn't tell me who he was because he didn't know. His mother had attributed the confusion to being biracial, but it also reflected the question of whether he was his mother's son or his father's, American or Guatemalan, good or evil. A catalogue of dialectics too long to enumerate. In that ugly room, in an ugly neighborhood, he knew exactly who he was, which allowed him to relax as I had never seen him relax before. I had been surprised to be drawn to the world of the deaf, but it was much stranger to be seduced by this world. Yet from the inside, gangbanging was hospitable. I did not like hanging out with the Sorrenos any more than I'd liked my morning with the Ananda Margis and their lentils, but I did not like it any less either. I knew that many of the people in that room had committed murder. They were kind to me, however, as a kindness to Krishna, a consideration for which he was clearly starved. That cordiality felt authentic and embracing. I had assumed that hanging out with the gang in the slums of Guatemala City would show me the toughest part of Krishna, but instead, it showed me the most vulnerable. Criminality is an identity, and like any other form of organized brutality, football, war, arbitrage, it can beget great intimacy. The social imperative is to suppress criminal behavior, but that should not preclude noticing the identity. I deplore violence, but I recognize the military intimacy it allows men who have no other occasion to bond. Indeed, I recognize that the conquests by which the map of the world is drawn derive from the loyalty and aggression of young men. My last day in Guatemala, Raul had arranged for Krishna's grandfather to drive me to the airport. "Hey," said Krishna, "you want me to come with you?" A little gallantly, he picked up my suitcase to take to the car. During the drive, he told me about Guatemalan poetry, and I mentioned Elizabeth Bishop's poems from Brazil, which captured the displacement between the two Americas. I quoted some favorite lines, and he borrowed a pen to write them down. I had expected simply to be dropped off, but at the airport Krishna grabbed my suitcase out of my hand again, accompanied me inside, and picked a good line for me. Good, he explained, because he could really be into the girl at the counter. He waited until I had checked in, and escorted me to the security zone. I walked into the secured area, then turned around, and he was waving at me. "Thanks," he called out. "For what?" I said. "For coming. For everything," he said. "I'll miss you, man." He coughed, looked embarrassed, and hurried away. That image of him, almost forlorn, printed itself on my heart. For a gleaming moment, I saw the sweet Krishna whom both Raul and Carol had described. Krishna moved back to Minneapolis to live with his mother again, and the next I heard he had been shot and was in critical condition. He'd lost a kidney and part of his gallbladder, and he had lacerations on his liver, a collapsed lung, and catastrophic bleeding. When he left the hospital, Carol asked him to find someplace else to live. "If they come to finish off the job," she said dryly, "I don't want it happening in my house." After that, he was mostly on the run. But when I couldn't reach him on his ever-changing cell numbers, I was able to keep up because he returned to his mother's house to do his laundry and ironing. 5 months later, Carol took him back. Then Krishna challenged some gang members, and they shot up the house. Ashoka, who had been on a long visit, returned to Guatemala the next day. In a letter she left for Krishna, she wrote, "I used to think you just needed focus, but now I feel like it's a slow form of suicide, and I don't want to be part of it." Carol said, "So I'm losing both my children again." A month later, Krishna got 16 months for assault. This time, he went to the big house. When I visited, he apologized for the fictions he'd told me. The gang had disappointed him by then. One of the Sorrenos in the incident had turned state's witness. I mean, don't join the gang if you can't understand. We have rules, we have bylaws, there is stuff you have to do and stuff you can't do. I proposed that if following rules were so attractive, he might as well follow the one set by the U.S. government, and he laughed. Krishna called Carol every week. He calls me because he's allowed to, she said. I've been so stupid to keep thinking that those speeches about doing better meant anything. I asked, what about that optimism you expressed in the play you were writing? And he said, those were just words. Where's the reality? I'd give anything to be able to find it. Even if it's ugly, really, really ugly, I could accept it if I could only see it, even for a few minutes. That's my dream. She looked at me sadly. Andrew, I know you better than I know my son. The next time Krishna was released from prison, he took his ACTs and sent the scores to several colleges, including UCLA, which was his first choice. But before his applications could be processed, he accompanied four fellow gang members on a drive that culminated in the shooting death of a member of the Vatos Locos gang. He was charged with aiding an offender for the benefit of a gang, pleaded guilty, and was sentenced to 8 years in Minnesota's Stillwater Maximum Security Prison. Krishna could have found community elsewhere if he hadn't been too petrified to try. He was certainly smart enough to go to UCLA. He hid behind bluster to avoid risks that scared him, and the guns he toted were only transitional objects, a flashier edition of Linus's security blanket. His freshman year shimmers on a dreamed horizon. To his what is, there is a vast what might have been, and he is haunted by it. Finding a horizontal identity can be life's greatest liberation, but it can also be crushing, and in this case, the figurative prison consigned Krishna to a literal one. Stillwater has a vast grayness. Krishna looked spruce whenever he entered the visiting room, but his idealist streak had dimmed. I don't hate Carol anymore, he said to me one afternoon there. I used to think she was the one who had made me powerless, but now I think she loved me in whatever way she knows how. I just felt so powerless growing up, not getting to choose where to live, and I finally realized I joined the gang so I could feel really powerful. And what's the upshot? I'm totally powerless again, right back where I started. Only this time, I did it to myself. Carol said to me a few weeks later, he wanted to work with the oppressed, to be with his people, with the disenfranchised Latinos. But what has he done? He gets them to kill each other. He lands them in prison. The people, he says, are his people. They'd be better off without him. I asked her if she thought she would be better off without him, and she said, I've been without him the whole time. I don't really miss who he is at all, but who he was, I'm pretty sure I'm right about who he was, and I miss that person so much, and the person I thought that person would turn into, I miss him too. With all my heart. No other group of people has given me more confused information than these juvenile criminals. They didn't trust or like adult, white, male authority figures, and their knee-jerk dissembling was part of what had landed them in prison in the first place. More fundamentally, though, they didn't grasp their own reality. They didn't know for sure what had happened. Their narratives were all conditional. Jail concentrates human emotions because it confiscates so many normal human actions and robs the inmate of so many ordinary decisions. What to eat, when to eat it, when to shower, and on and on. When you are not on the street, fending for yourself, running from crime to crime, taking drugs that banish the world, you are compelled into reflection. In this pensive state, prisoners dwell on love and hate, on reunion and vengeance. They contemplate how to get back at whoever put them in the box. Virtually all the prisoners I met blamed someone else for their incarceration, if not for their crime. They also long for the people who offer them succor. A husband or wife, a boyfriend or girlfriend, the prisoner's children, parents whose relatively untempered love becomes a cherished souvenir of innocence. The wrongs Krishna had endured were far more real to him than the ones he'd inflicted on others. I met other kids, though, who seemed to have become criminals to give some objective weight to a previous and crippling sense of guilt. One boy I befriended at the home school, Tyndall Wilkie, had a fight with his mother, a preschool teacher, when he was 6, and told the school nurse that she had been abusing him, then repeated the story to the school social worker. She hadn't abused him. He just wanted to get her in trouble. Tyndall and his sister were put into permanent foster care. His mother was banned from teaching for 5 years. His whole life unfolded in the shadow of this error. Mitt Ebbets, a gang kid at another prison, described how when he was 8, his mother would leave him in charge of his younger sisters, cautioning him never to answer the door. One day, the knocking was so insistent that he couldn't ignore it. It was the police, responding to a neighbor's complaint about the children being left home alone. They were taken from her care and caromed from foster home to foster home. Like Lord Jim, Mitt was haunted by one error. He felt he had ruined his mother's and sister's lives and so eviscerated his own moral center. His later offenses, drug peddling and assault, fulfilled his need for self-punishment. The legend of crime is that it is spurred by parents who hurt their children. The legacy of crime is that children hurt their parents. Often, the pain attached to that transgression blots out all other remorse. Love is not only an intuition, but also a skill. Therapeutic prison programs such as the home schools provide structure and momentum for reflection via group sessions, diaries, and letter writing. Having a child at the home school also provides learning opportunities for the child's parents. Prison defines parameters for affection that are easier for some people than the unmapped everyday world. You come on visiting day. You stay the whole time. You bring in those sneakers, or help hold on to the girlfriend by treating her as part of your family. These obvious concrete actions do not depend on sustaining a mood, which many people of short temper and shifting emotion find difficult. People who cannot achieve constancy from minute to minute can sometimes sustain it once a week. A valid trust, my parents said they would come on visiting day, and they did, was nearly revelatory for many prisoners. In some cases, this support vanished when the child was released, but in others it functioned as training wheels. By the time the child's sentence was up, the parents were ready to perform their roles with new confidence and skill, unassisted. Ideally, a juvenile's reintegration into the family can also be a mirroring of his or her pending reintegration into society at large. The first time I attended family visiting day at the Department of Community Corrections of Hennepin County, I was talking to two boys who seemed to be in much the same situation. They were the same age, had similar sentences, and were being released at about the same time. I soon learned, however, that the parents of one had traveled 2 hours to show up for every court date, every family counseling session, and every visiting hour. The boy's mother had already lined up a construction job for his release. The other boy half-heartedly joined in with his friend's family because his own middle-class, educated family, who lived less than 2 miles from the facility, never came. These two inmates were being released into different worlds. I visited Castington, a high-security prison near Newcastle in the north of England, and found it more traditional and physically shabbier than the home school. In Minnesota, staff would always tell the residents that they were under no obligation to talk to me. At Castington, I was invited to observe procedures and was present, for example, when new arrivals were strip-searched. The English inmates had not achieved the self-knowledge, or even the illusion of self-knowledge, that characterized their homeschool counterparts. Frank Buckland, in prison for slashing the face of his cousin's boyfriend, seemed daunted by his approaching release date. "I've got the violence pretty well under control in here," Frank said. He had in fact been a model prisoner. "But I want to go out like the other blokes, have a drink, meet some girls. I don't know whether I'll go violent again." He spoke of his future character as though it were a mystery beyond his control. "We'll just have to wait and see," his mother echoed helplessly. The young people at the homeschool were taught to begin thinking about and planning for what they were going to do on the outside. In contrast, I didn't meet a single Castington inmate who had any idea what he wanted to do with his life after his release. Reflections on the future from inside a prison are fantasies of sorts, but the coherence and hopefulness of any particular fantasy has considerable bearing on the inmate's ability to turn his or her life around after prison. That Krishna spent his steak dinner with me extolling the virtues of gang life was a bad sign. Just as Karina's using her boyfriend's murder as a reason to complete her GED was a promising one. The homeschool provides a step-down program in which inmates are slowly returned to the world with supportive services. Terry Bach said, "I've had parents who feel comfortable calling me if something goes wrong after the kid gets out." Karina had remained close to her favorite correctional officer and had turned to her for advice from time to time. The injection of humanity into these relationships is enormously productive. For most horizontal identities, the issue of collective innocence is central. The heart-tugging argument is that disabled children do not deserve to be castigated. Here, we deal with guilty children, and in some cases with parents who have grossly erred. Yet many of these families have also been marginalized and brutalized, emotionally and economically isolated, depressed and frustrated. I kept meeting parents who wanted to help their kids, but didn't have the knowledge or means to do so effectively. Like the parents of disabled children, they couldn't access the social services to which they were ostensibly entitled. Heaping opprobrium on these parents exacerbates a problem we could instead resolve. We deny the reality of their lives not only at the expense of our humanity, but also at our personal peril. Criminality appears to be more subject to resolve than many other conditions. No one can will his way out of Down syndrome, but some people can walk away from a criminal past. They usually require enormous supports to do so. Research on preventing crime has hatched a panoply of effective solutions, but we ignore most, writing off vast sectors of our society. While nearly three-quarters of people working with juvenile delinquents believe effective ways exist to treat the problem, only 3 to 6% believe that the juvenile courts are helping. Our lack of sympathy for these pariah children keeps successful treatment out of their reach. Aside from the common prejudice that therapeutic interventions are excessively soft on the criminal, the justification for withholding such treatments is often that they are ineffective and exorbitantly expensive. Neither justification has merit. The cost of jailing a minor ranges from about $20,000 to $65,000 per year. Prisons with more programs experience less violence, which reduces some expenses. But the major financial benefit lies in curtailed recidivism. A crime gives rise to enormous knock-on costs, including loss of property, trial expenses, healthcare costs from injury, and psychological liabilities sustained by frightened victims. Joseph Califano, head of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, said, "Treatment and accountability are complementary rather than mutually exclusive objectives." In a meta-analysis of 163 studies, William R. Shadish, professor of psychology at the University of California, Merced, demonstrated that family interventions are the most productive ones. Another meta-analysis concluded, "The use of family and parenting interventions can result in a significant reduction in time spent in institutions such as prison and detention centers by juvenile delinquents." As with autism or Down syndrome, early intervention brings the best results. The 2001 U.S. Surgeon General's report on youth violence confirmed that prenatal home visits to teach parenting skills to expectant mothers can reduce juvenile crime. Such programs are most effective when they are followed up. One researcher likened the approach to the dental model, in which regular maintenance is required to ensure good health, not the vaccination model, in which a single early childhood action can prevent disease. An impatient society wants treatment to be more targeted, so most family programs do not set in until at-risk children are older and address only the families of known offenders. These therapies are mostly known by abbreviations: BPT, FFT, MST, SFT, BSFT, MFGI, FAST, FET, TFC. Most draw on cognitive behavioral models. Parents learn how to be consistent, fair, and emotionally open. Children learn how to identify their feelings, manage their anger, and communicate better. Together, kids and parents improve conflict resolution skills. Some therapies also deal with practical matters, such as helping families to get adequate housing, food, and clothing. Some put children into model foster care environments and then bring the biological family to observe the foster family as a prelude to returning the child to them. Alan Kasdan and his team at the Yale Parenting Center advocate disciplinary measures that are not associated with violence or fear. Altering the home correctional system can steer young people clear of the state one. One study posited that a behavioral communication approach could reduce recidivism by half. Another showed that kids on probation in a control group were almost 10 times more likely to reoffend than similar kids who participated in family therapy. Another reported that institutionalized delinquents who received family therapy in prison had a recidivism rate of 60%, compared to a Sisyphean 93% rate for those who didn't. At-risk children whose families received no early therapy were 70% more likely to be arrested for a violent crime before they turned 18 than those whose families had received such therapy. These statistics have had little effect on how we deal with juvenile crime. Only 1 of 10 juvenile prisons uses family therapies, and only about a quarter of these do so consistently. We rail against the atrocities perpetrated by kids, but we consistently choose the satisfaction of retribution over the efficacy of prevention. Basic family interventions, in approximate terms, can run anywhere from $2,000 to $30,000 per family served. The high-scope Perry Preschool Project showed that for new mothers deemed to be at risk, every dollar spent on treatment saved $7 in later costs, a number that didn't even take into account the positive economic contributions of this non-offending population. While California's Three Strikes Law has a cost per serious crime prevented of $16,000 and parole comes in at just under $14,000, parent training has a cost per serious crime prevented of just $6,351. Extremely good results have been shown for relatively inexpensive graduation incentives that keep kids in school. The Perry Project suggests that failing to intervene with at-risk low-income families with children under 5 in the United States may cost us as much as $400 billion. But while money spent on deterrence this year may vastly reduce prison expenses a decade down the line, it's hard to apply this equivalence to a line-item budget, especially one that needs to pay off within a political term. Moral questions loom large in any discussion of such treatments. What message do we convey if we respond to violent crime with therapy? If we opt for less prison time, more crimes will be committed by people who would otherwise have been locked up. Three Strikes was designed to reduce adult crime by 25% in California, a goal it may or may not have achieved. No preventive or therapeutic program has ever arrived at such ambitious goals. On the other hand, Three Strikes is scandalously expensive, and the state is on the verge of bankruptcy. We can't dismantle the justice system or knock out crime with kindness. Fire is often needed to fight fire. At the same time, the overwhelming evidence is that punitive justice can be strengthened with therapeutic programs. To discard the prison system in favor of therapeutic interventions would be crazy, but a prison system that is used without therapeutic intervention, as in much of the country today, is at least equally crazy. A peculiar arrogance accrues to people who cannot recognize the diversity of human impulses, and who feel superior because they do not lapse into behaviors that don't tempt them in the first place. People disgusted by sexual predators say smugly that they don't pursue the sexual favors of children, without acknowledging that they don't find children sexually attractive. Those who do not tend toward chemical dependency express disdain for addicts. People with small appetites patronize the morbidly obese. 100 years ago, my homosexuality would have landed me in jail, and I am fortunate to live in a place and an era that allow me to be true to myself. If I'd had to deny my longings, it would have been a different experience from that of straight people who have no such longings to deny. Spending time with criminals, I have seen that while many have poor impulse control, or are weak, or stupid, or destructive, many others are driven by a compulsion. Some manifest enormous courage by refraining from theft, although the wish to steal burns in them every minute, and their restraint of demons they cannot eradicate is categorically different from the lawfulness of people who find the idea of thievery distasteful. Families of criminals often struggle both to admit that their child has done something destructive and to continue to love him anyway. Some give up the love. Some blind themselves to the bad behavior. The ideal of doing neither of those things borrows from the idea of loving the sinner while hating the sin. But sinners and sins cannot so easily be separated. If human beings love sinners, we love them with their sin. People who see and acknowledge the darkness in those they love, but whose love is only strengthened by that knowledge, achieve that truest love that is eagle-eyed even when the views are bleak. I met one family whose own tragedy had led them to embrace these contradictions more than any other. One mother whose love seemed both infinitely deep and infinitely knowing of a blighted person. Hers was a love as dark and true, as embracing and self-abnegating as Cordelia's. On April 20th, 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold seniors at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, placed bombs in the cafeteria, set to go off during first lunch period at 11:17 a.m., and planned to shoot anyone who tried to flee. Errors in the construction of the detonators prevented the bombs from exploding. But Klebold and Harris nevertheless held the whole school hostage, killing 12 students and one teacher before turning their guns on themselves. At the time, it was the worst episode of school violence in history. The American right blamed the collapse of family values, while the left mounted assaults on violence in the movies and sought to tighten gun control laws. Wholesale critiques of the larger culture were offered as explanation for these inexplicable events. The number of people killed that day is generally listed as 13, and the Columbine Memorial commemorates only 13 deaths, as though Klebold and Harris had not also died that day in that place. Contrary to wide speculation then and since, the boys did not come from broken homes, and did not have records of criminal violence. The wishful thought of a world that witnessed this horror was that good parenting could prevent children from developing into Eric Harris or Dylan Klebold. But malevolence does not always grow in a predictable or accountable manner. As the families of autistics or schizophrenics wonder what happened to the apparently healthy people they knew, other families grapple with children who have turned to horrifying acts and wonder what happened to the innocent children they thought they understood. I set out to interview Tom and Sue Klebold with the expectation that meeting them would help to illuminate their son's actions. The better I came to know the Klebolds, the more deeply mystified I became. Sue Klebold's kindness, before Dylan's death, she worked with people with disabilities, would be the answered prayer of many a neglected or abused child, and Tom's bullish enthusiasm would lift anyone's tired spirits. Among the many families I've met in writing this book, the Klebolds are among those I would be most game to join. Trapped in their own private Oresteia, they learned astonishing forgiveness and empathy. They are victims of the terrifying, profound unknowability of even the most intimate human relationship. It is easier to love a good person than a bad one, but it may be more difficult to lose a bad person you love than a good one. Sue Klebold once said to me, "I watched Rosemary's Baby the other night, and my heart really went out to Rosemary." When Barbara Walters interviewed the father of one of Dylan's classmates after the event, he said of the Klebolds, "They're in a glass cage, and they have no more pieces to this puzzle than anybody else." The last Sue Klebold heard from Dylan, the younger of her two children, was, "Bye," as he let the front door slam on his way to school that April 20th. In the middle of the day, Tom received a call about the shootings at school and learned that Dylan was a suspect. He called Sue. "I had a sudden vision of what he might be doing," Sue said. "And so while every other mother in Littleton was praying that her child was safe, I had to pray that mine would die before he hurt anyone else. I thought if this was really happening and he survived, he would go into the criminal justice system and be executed, and I couldn't bear to lose him twice. I gave the hardest prayer I ever made, that he would kill himself, because then at least I would know that he wanted to die and wouldn't be left with all the questions I'd have if he got caught by a police bullet. Maybe I was right, but I spent so many hours regretting that prayer. I wished for my son to kill himself, and he did." That night, police told the Klebolds to leave their house, both so the police could turn it inside out and for their own safety. "I thought about Dylan being dead," Sue said, "and I thought he was young and healthy, and maybe he could be an organ donor. And then I thought, would anyone want the organs of a murderer?" That was my first taste of how the world would see my son. The Klebolds went to stay with Tom's sister for 4 days, returning home on the day of Dylan's funeral. "We didn't really know what had happened," Sue said. "We just knew Dylan was dead, that he'd killed himself, that he was involved with the shooting." As Littleton's period of mourning began, a carpenter from Illinois erected 15 crosses on a hillside near the school. "I was so buoyed by this," Tom said. "I wanted to be a part of the community, and I thought we could all grieve together." Sue remembered, "There were flowers, and Dylan's and Eric's crosses had as many as everybody else's." Then the parents of some of the victims destroyed Dylan's and Eric's crosses. The youth group at a local church planted 15 trees, only to have some of the victims' parents arrive with a press escort to chop down Dylan's and Eric's trees. At the high school graduation ceremony a week later, there were encomiums for the victims, but the head of the school told friends of Dylan and Eric to make themselves scarce. Before long, reports referring to the incident started using the number 13 rather than 15. "The shorthand was this," Tom said. 13 kids died, 2 Nazis killed them, and the parents were responsible. It was a lynch mob. Sue said reflectively, "I think the other parents believed they had experienced loss, and I had not, because their children were of value, and mine was not. My child died too. He died after making a terrible decision and doing a terrible thing, but he was still my child, and he still died." The Klebolds' lawyer had advised them not to talk to the press. Their silence exacerbated local hostility. "You'd read something and you couldn't respond to it," Tom said. "You knew that it was false, misleading, inflammatory." Sue said, "It was just like constantly being hit, and being hit again, and you couldn't fight back." In an act of agonizing catharsis, Sue handwrote notes to the parents of each child who had died or been injured. Though she did not feel responsible for what had happened, she wanted to mitigate the devastation. "To me, the only way to heal this community was to try to have a one-to-one relationship with each of the victims," she later explained. "My journey is not complete until I can say to these people, if you ever want to speak to me, I am available to you. I will meet you in your home, a pastor's office, with a mediator if you want. If it would help you to talk to me, I'm here." She has never done it because a counselor cautioned her that by contacting them, she might re-traumatize them. "But I cried for their children just as I did for mine," she said. While the Klebolds faced a great deal of hostility, moments of unusual love also surfaced. "A few weeks after Columbine happened, I got a hug from the checkout clerk at Home Depot," Tom said. "Neighbors brought us food. And when I took my car in to have a bent wheel fixed, the mechanic said to me, 'At least you didn't change your name.' He respected that." Investigations over the ensuing months revealed an atmosphere of bullying at Columbine. "Unless you are part of the in crowd and had your athletic resume, you had no status," Tom said. So Dylan had to be resentful. The only thing that would certainly have prevented Columbine would have been to eliminate the chip on his shoulder. And the chip sprang from that school. He and Eric didn't shoot us. And they didn't shoot up Kmart or a gas station. They shot up the school. The whole social pattern at Columbine was unfair, and Dylan couldn't do anything about it. That would cause enough anger in a sensitive kid to make him retaliate. Unbeknownst to the Klebolds, Dylan had experienced significant humiliation at school, though he was 6'4" and not easy to push around. He had come home one day with ketchup spots all over his shirt, and when his mother asked what had happened, he said he'd had the worst day of his life and didn't want to talk about it. Months after his death, she learned of an incident in which Dylan and Eric had apparently been shoved and squirted with ketchup by kids calling them fags. It hurt so much that I'd seen the remnants of that day and hadn't helped him, she said. When Tom went to pick up Dylan's car from a police station a few weeks after the event, one of the officers said to him, "My son came home from that school one day, and they'd set his hair on fire right in the hall. His whole scalp was burned. I wanted to take that school apart brick by brick, but he said it would only make it worse." A year after the massacre, the police turned over Dylan's journals to the Klebolds, who hadn't known of their existence. "Dylan's writing is full of 'I'm smarter than they are,'" Sue said. "He experienced disdain for the people who were mistreating him. He liked to think of himself as perfect, I think, and that grandiosity came through in the shootings. He started being more withdrawn and secretive in the last 2 years of high school, but that's not so unusual. The stereotype that he and Eric were these miserable little kids who were plotting because they were so isolated is false. He was bright. He was very shy. He had friends, and they liked him. I was as shocked hearing that my son was perceived as an outcast as I was hearing that he'd been involved in a shooting. He cared for other people." Tom demurred. Or he seemed to. "I can never decide whether it's worse to think your child was hardwired to be like this, and that you couldn't have done anything, or to think he was a good person and something set this off in him," Sue said. "What I've learned from being an outcast since the tragedy has given me insight into what it must have felt like for my son to be marginalized. He created a version of his reality for us, to be pariahs, unpopular, with no means to defend ourselves against those who hate us." Their attorney filtered their piles of mail so they would not see the worst of it. "I could read 300 letters where people were saying, 'I admire you, I'm praying for you,' and I'd read one hate letter and be destroyed," Sue said. "When people devalue you, it far outweighs all the love." Tom, like Dylan, had been painfully shy in high school and felt that because of their similarities he knew Dylan instinctively. He can identify with how Dylan may have felt, but not with what he did. Sue sees a terrible confluence of circumstances, including depression, a school environment that caused rage, and an influential friend who had severe problems. Dylan felt a little afraid of Eric, a little protective of him, and a little controlled by him, she said. "He was caught in something I don't understand that made him do this horrible thing. But I don't, can't believe that that is who he was. Yes, he made a conscious choice and did this horrible thing, but what had happened to his consciousness that he would make such a choice? Something in him got broken. The same pathology that killed and hurt all the others also killed my son." I was surprised that the Klebolds had stayed in the town, where they had been party to so much anguish. "If we had moved and changed our names, the press would have figured it out," Sue said. "I would have been the mother of that killer in the eyes of everyone I met. Here at least I had people who liked me as me, and people who had liked Dylan, and that was what I needed, especially people who had liked Dylan." Tom said bluntly, "If we'd left, they would have won. Staying was my defiance of the people who were trying to grind us into the ground. I ventured that it must have been hard to keep loving Dylan through the aftermath," and Sue replied, "No, it never was. That was the easy part. Trying to understand was hard, coping with the loss was hard, reconciling myself to the consequences of his actions was hard, But loving him, no, that was always easy for me. It seemed